This is Audible.
Time Warner Audiobooks presents First to Die, a novel by James Patterson. Acknowledgements. My thanks to the following people whose hard work and expertise helped in the writing of this book. Dr. Greg Zuhrman, Chief of Neurosurgery, Lakeland Hospital, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who I'd like on my side in a crisis. The lovely and talented Fern Galperin, Mary Jordan, Barbara Grisevsky, and Irene Markaki. Prologue. Inspector Lindsay Boxer. It is an unusually warm night in July, but I'm shivering badly as I stand on the substantial gray stone terrace outside my apartment. I'm looking out over glorious San Francisco, and I have my service revolver pressed against the side of my temple. "God damn you, God," I whisper. Quite a sentiment, but appropriate and just, I think. I hear Sweet Martha whimpering. I turn and see she is watching me through the glass doors that lead to the terrace. She knows that something is wrong. "It's okay," I call to her through the door. "I'm okay. Go lie down, girl." Martha won't leave, though, won't look away. She's a good, loyal friend who's been nuzzling me good night every single night for the past 6 years. As I stare into the border collie's eyes, I think that maybe I should go inside and call the girls. Claire, Cindy, and Jill would be here almost before I hung up the phone. They would hold me, hug me, say all the right things. "You're special, Lindsay. Everybody loves you, Lindsay." Only I'm pretty sure that I'd be back out here tomorrow night, or the night after. I just don't see a way out of this mess. I have thought it all through 100 times. I can be as logical as hell, but I am also highly emotional, obviously. That was my strength as an inspector with the San Francisco Police Department. It is a rare combination, and I think it is why I was more successful than any of the males in homicide. Of course, none of them are up here getting ready to blow their brains out with their own guns. I lightly brush the barrel of the revolver down my cheek, and then up to my temple again. "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God." I am reminded of soft hands, of Chris, and that starts me crying. Lots of images are coming, way too fast for me to handle. The terrible, indelible honeymoon murders that terrified our city, mixed with close-ups of my mom, and even a few flashes of my father. My best girls, Claire, Cindy, and Jill, our crazy club. I can even see myself, the way I used to be, anyway. Nobody ever, ever thought that I looked like an inspector, the only woman homicide inspector in the entire SFPD. My friends always said I was more like Helen Hunt, married to Paul Reiser in Mad About You. I was married once. I was no Helen Hunt. He sure was no Paul Reiser. This is so hard, so bad, so wrong. It's so unlike me. I keep seeing David and Melanie Brandt, the first couple who were killed, in the Mandarin suite of the Grand Hyatt. I see that horrifying hotel room where they died senselessly and needlessly. That was the beginning. Book One. David and Melanie. Chapter 1. Beautiful long-stemmed red roses filled the hotel suite. The perfect gifts, really. Everything was perfect. There might be a luckier man somewhere on the planet, David Brandt thought as he wrapped his arms around Melanie, his new bride. Somewhere in Yemen, maybe. Some Allah-praising farmer with a second goat. But certainly not in all of San Francisco. The couple looked out from the living room of the Grand Hyatt's Mandarin suite. They could see the lights of Berkeley off in the distance. Alcatraz, the graceful outline of the lit-up Golden Gate Bridge. "It's incredible," Melanie beamed. "I wouldn't change a single thing about today." "Me either," he whispered. Well, maybe I wouldn't have invited my parents. They both laughed. Only moments before, they had bid farewell to the last of the 300 guests in the hotel's ballroom. The wedding was finally over. The toasts, the dancing, the schmoozing, the photographed kisses over the cake. Now it was just the two of them. They were 29 years old and had the rest of their lives ahead of them. David reached for a pair of filled champagne glasses he had set on a lacquered table. "A toast," he declared, "to the second luckiest man alive." "The second?" she said, and smiled in pretended shock. "Who's the first?" They looped arms and took a long, luxurious sip from the crystal glasses. "This farmer with two goats. I'll tell you later." "I have something for you," David suddenly remembered. He had already given her the perfect 5-carat diamond on her finger, which he knew she wore only to please his folks. He went to his tuxedo jacket, which was draped over a high-backed chair, and returned with a jewelry box from Bulgari.
"No, David," Melanie protested, "you're my gift."
"Open it anyway," he said to her. "This you'll like." She lifted the top. Inside a suede pouch was a set of earrings, large silver rings around a pair of whimsical moons made from diamonds. "They're how I think of you," he said. Melanie held the moons against the lobes of her ears. They were perfect, and so was she. "It's you who pulls my tides," David murmured. They kissed, and he unfastened the zipper of her dress, letting the neckline fall just below her shoulders. He kissed her neck, then the top of her breasts. There was a knock on the door of the suite.
"Champagne,"
called a voice from outside. For a moment, David thought of just yelling,
"Leave it there!"
All evening, he had longed to peel away the dress from his wife's soft white shoulders.
"Oh, go get it,"
Melanie whispered, dangling the earrings in front of his eyes.
"I'll put these on."
She wiggled out of his grasp, backing toward the Mandarin's master bathroom, a smile in her liquid brown eyes. God, he loved those eyes. As he went to the door, David was thinking he wouldn't trade places with anybody in the world. Not even for a second goat. Chapter 2. Philip Campbell had imagined this moment, this exquisite scene, so many times. He knew it would be the groom who opened the door. He stepped into the room.
"Congratulations," Campbell muttered, handing over the champagne.
He stared at the man in the open tuxedo shirt with a black tie dangling around his neck. David Brandt barely looked at him as he inspected the brightly ribboned box. Krug, Claude Dumenil, 1989. "What is the worst thing anyone has ever done?" Campbell murmured to himself. "Am I capable of doing it? Do I have what it takes?"
"Any card?" the groom said, fumbling in his pants pocket for a tip. "Only this, sir."
Campbell stepped forward and plunged a knife deep into the groom's chest, between the third and fourth ribs, the closest route to the heart. "For the man who has everything," Campbell said. He pushed his way into the room and slammed the door shut with a swift kick. He spun David Brandt around, shoved his back against the door, and powered the blade in deeper. The groom stiffened in a spasm of shock and pain. Guttural sounds escaped from his chest, tiny, gurgling, choking breaths. His eyes bulged in disbelief. "This is amazing," Campbell thought. He could actually feel the groom's strength leaking away. The man had just experienced one of the great moments of his life, and now, minutes later, he was dying. Campbell stepped back, and the groom's body crumpled to the floor. The room began to tilt like a listing boat. Then everything began to speed up and run together. He felt as if he were watching a flickering newsreel. Amazing. Nothing like he had expected. Campbell heard the wife's voice and had the presence of mind to pull the blade out of David Brandt's chest. He rushed to intercept her as she came from the bedroom, still in her long, lacy gown.
"David,"
she said with an expectant smile that turned to shock at the sight of Campbell.
"Where's David? Who are you?
Her eyes traveled over him, terror-ridden, fixing on his face, the knife blade, then to her husband's body on the floor.
Oh, my God! David!
She screamed.
Oh, David! David!
Campbell wanted to remember her like this. The frozen, wide-eyed look. The promise and hope that just moments ago had shined so brightly were now shattered. The words poured from his mouth. You want to know why? Well, so do I.
What have you done?
Melanie screamed again. She struggled to understand. Her terrified eyes darted back and forth, sweeping the room for a way out. She made a sudden dash for the living room door. Campbell grabbed her wrist and brought the bloody knife up to her throat.
Please, she whimpered, her eyes frozen. Please don't kill me.
The truth is, Melanie, I'm here to save you, he said as he smiled into her quivering face.
Campbell lowered the blade and sliced into her. The slender body jolted up with a sudden cry. Her eyes flickered like a weak electric bulb. A deathly rattle shot through her.
Why?
Her begging eyes pleaded.
Why?
It took a full minute for him to regain his breath. The smell of Melanie Brandt's blood was deep in his nostrils. He almost couldn't believe what he had done. He carried the bride's body back into the bedroom and placed her on the bed. She was beautiful. Delicate features. And so young. He remembered when he had first seen her and how he had been taken with her then. She had thought the whole world was in front of her. He rubbed his hand against the smooth surface of her cheek and cupped one of her earrings, a smiling moon. What is the worst thing anyone has ever done? Philip Campbell asked himself again, heart pounding in his chest. Was this it? Had he just done it? Not yet, a voice inside answered. Not quite yet. Slowly, he lifted the bride's beautiful white wedding dress. Chapter 3. It was a little before 8:30 on a Monday morning in June, one of those chilly, gray summer mornings San Francisco is famous for. I was starting the week off badly, flipping through old copies of The New Yorker while waiting for my GP, Dr. Roy Orenthaler, to free up. I'd been seeing Dr. Roy, as I still sometimes called him, ever since I was a sociology major at San Francisco University, and I obligingly came in once a year for my checkup. That was last Tuesday. To my surprise, he had called at the end of the week and asked me to stop in today before work. I had a busy day ahead of me, two open cases and a deposition to deliver at district court. I was hoping I could be at my desk by 9. Miss Boxer, the receptionist finally called to me, the doctor will see you now. I followed her into the doctor's office. Generally, Orenthaler greeted me with some well-intended stab at police humor, such as, so, if you are here, who's out on the street after them? I was now 34, and for the past 2 years had been lead inspector on the homicide detail out of the Hall of Justice. But today, he rose stiffly and uttered a solemn, Lindsay. He motioned me to the chair across from his desk. Uh-oh. Up until then, my philosophy on doctors had been simple. When one of them gave you that deep, concerned look and told you to take a seat, three things could happen. Only one of them was bad. They were either asking you out, getting ready to lay on some bad news, or they'd just spent a fortune reupholstering the furniture. "I want to show you something," Orenthaler began. He held a slide up against a light. He pointed to splotches of tiny ghost-like spheres in a current of smaller pellets. "This is a blow-up of the blood smear we took from you. The larger globules are erythrocytes, red blood cells."
They seem happy, I joked nervously.
They are, Lindsay, the doctor said without a trace of a smile. Problem is, you don't have many. I fixed on his eyes, hoping they would relax and that we'd move on to something trivial like, you better start cutting down those long hours, Lindsay. There's a condition, Lindsay, Orenthaler went on. Negli's aplastic anemia. It's rare. Basically, the body no longer manufactures red blood cells.
He held up a photo.
This is what a normal blood workup looks like.
On this one, the dark background looked like the intersection of Market and Powell at 5 p.m., a virtual traffic jam of compressed, energetic spheres. Speedy messengers all carrying oxygen to parts of someone else's body. In contrast, mine looked about as densely packed as a political headquarters 2 hours after the candidate has conceded.
This is treatable, right? I asked him, more like I was telling him. It's treatable, Lindsay, Orenthaler said after a pause. But it's serious.
A week ago, I had come in simply because my eyes were runny and blotchy and I'd discovered some blood in my panties. And every day by 3, I was suddenly feeling like some iron-deficient gnome was inside me siphoning off my energy. Me, of the regular double shifts and 14-hour days. 6 weeks accrued vacation.
How serious are we talking about? I asked, my voice catching. Red blood cells are vital to the body's process of oxygenation, Orenthaler began to explain. Hemopoiesis, the formation of blood cells in the bone marrow.
Dr. Roy, this isn't a medical conference. How serious are we talking about?
What is it you want to hear, Lindsay? Diagnosis or possibility?
I want to hear the truth.
Orenthaler nodded. He got up and came around the desk and took my hand. Then, here's the truth, Lindsay. What you have is life-threatening.
Life-threatening?
My heart stopped. My throat was as dry as parchment. Fatal, Lindsay. Chapter 4.
The cold, blunt sound of the word hit me like a hollow-point shell between the eyes.
Fatal, Lindsay.
I waited for Dr. Roy to tell me this was all some kind of sick joke, that he had my tests mixed up with someone else's.
I want to send you to a hematologist, Lindsay, Orenthaler went on. Like a lot of diseases, there are stages. Stage 1 is when there's a mild depletion of cells. It can be treated with monthly transfusions. Stage 2 is when there's a systemic shortage of red cells. Stage 3 would require hospitalization. A bone marrow transplant. Potentially the removal of your spleen.
So, where am I? I asked, sucking in a cramped lungful of air.
Your erythrocytic count is barely 200 per cc of raw blood. That puts you on the cusp.
The cusp?
The cusp, the doctor said, between stages 2 and 3.
There comes a point in everybody's life when you realize the stakes have suddenly changed. The carefree ride of your life slams into a stone wall. All those years of merely bouncing along, life taking you where you want to go, abruptly end. In my job, I see this moment forced on people all the time. Welcome to mine.
So, what does this mean? I asked weakly. The room was spinning a little now. What it means, Lindsay, is that you're going to have to undergo a prolonged regimen of intensive treatment.
I shook my head. What does it mean for my job?
I'd been in homicide for 6 years now, the past 2 as lead homicide inspector. With any luck, when my lieutenant was up for promotion, I'd be in line for his job. The department needed strong women. They could go far. Until that moment, I had thought that I would go far. Right now, the doctor said, I don't think it means anything. As long as you feel strong while you're undergoing treatment, you can continue to work. In fact, it might even be good therapy.
Suddenly, I felt as if the walls of the room were closing in on me and I was suffocating.
I'll give you the name of the hematologist, Orenthaler said.
He went on about the doctor's credentials, but I found myself no longer hearing him. I was thinking, who am I going to tell? Mom had died 10 years before. From breast cancer.
Dad had been out of the picture since I was 13. I had a sister, Cat, but she was living a nice, neat life down in Newport Beach. And for her, just making a right turn on red brought on a moment of crisis. The doctor pushed the referral toward me. I know you, Lindsay. You'll pretend this is something you can fix by working harder. But you can't. This is deadly serious. I want you to call him today. Suddenly my beeper sounded. I fumbled for it in my bag and looked at the number. It was the office. Jacoby. I need a phone, I said. Orenthaler shot me a reproving look, one that read, I told you, Lindsay. Like you said, I forced a nervous smile. Therapy. He nodded to the phone on his desk and left the room. I went through the motions of dialing my partner.
Fun's over, Boxer, Jacoby's gruff voice came on the line. We got a double 180, the Grand Hyatt.
My head was spinning with what the doctor had told me. In a fog, I must not have responded.
You hear me, Boxer? Work time. You on the way?
Yeah, I finally said.
And wear something nice, my partner grunted, like you would to a wedding.
Chapter 5. How I got from Dr. Orenthaler's office out in Noe Valley all the way to the Hyatt in Union Square, I don't remember. I kept hearing the doctor's words sounding over and over in my head. In severe cases, Naegeli's can be fatal. All I know is that barely 12 minutes after Jacoby's call, my 10-year-old Bronco screeched to a halt in front of the hotel's atrium entrance. The street was ablaze with police activity. Jesus, what the hell had happened? The entire block between Sutter and Union Square had been cordoned off by a barricade of blue and whites. In the hotel entrance, a cluster of uniforms crowded about, checking people going in and out, waving the crowd of onlookers away. I badged my way into the lobby. Two uniformed cops, whom I recognized, were standing in front. Murray, a pot-bellied cop in the last year of his hitch, and his younger partner, Vasquez. I asked Murray to bring me up to speed.
What I've been told is that there's two VIPs murdered on the 30th floor. All the brain power's up there now.
Who's presiding? I asked, feeling my energies returning.
Right now, I guess you are, Inspector.
In that case, I want all exits to the hotel immediately shut down, and get a list from the manager of all guests and staff. No one goes in or out unless they're on that list. Seconds later, I was riding up to the 30th floor. The trail of cops and official personnel led me down the hall to a set of open double doors marked Mandarin Suite. I ran into Charlie Clapper, the crime scene unit crew chief, lugging in his heavy cases with two techs. Clapper's being here himself meant this was big. Through the open double doors, I saw roses first. They were everywhere. Then I spotted Jacoby.
Watch your heels, Inspector,
he called loudly across the room. My partner was 47, but he looked 10 years older. His hair was white, and he was beginning to bald. His face always seemed on the verge of a smirk over some tasteless wisecrack. He and I had worked together for 2.5 years. I was senior, Inspector Sergeant, though he had 7 years on me in the department. He reported to me. Stepping into the suite, I almost tripped across the legs of body number one, the groom. He was lying just inside the front door, crumpled in a heap, in an open tuxedo shirt and pants. Blood matted the hair on his chest. I took a deep breath.
May I present Mr. David Brandt, Jacoby intoned with a crooked smile. Mrs. David Brandt's in there.
He gestured toward the bedroom.
Guess things went downhill for them quicker than most.
I knelt down and took a long, hard look at the dead groom. He was handsome, with short, dark, tousled hair and a soft jaw. But the wide, apoplectic eyes locked open, and the rivulet of dried blood on his chin marred the features. Behind him, his tuxedo jacket lay on the floor. "Who found them?" I asked, checking his pocket for a wallet.
"Assistant manager. They were supposed to fly to Bali this morning. The island, not the casino, Boxer. For these two, assistant managers do wake-up calls."
I opened the wallet. A New York driver's license with the groom's smiling face. Platinum cards, several $100 bills.
I got up and looked around the suite. It opened up into a stylish museum of Oriental art. Celadon dragons, chairs, and couches decorated with imperial court scenes. The roses, of course. I was more the cozy bed and breakfast type, but if you were into making a statement, this was about as substantial a statement as you could make.
"Let's meet the bride," Jacoby said.
I followed through a set of open double doors into the master bedroom and stopped. The bride lay on her back on a large canopy bed. I'd been to 100 homicides and could radar in on the body as quick as anyone, but this I wasn't prepared for. It sent a wave of compassion racing down my spine. The bride was still in her wedding dress. Chapter 6. You never see so many murder victims that it stops making you hurt, but this one was especially hard to look at. She was so young and beautiful, calm, tranquil, and undisturbed, except for the 3 crimson flowers of blood spread on her white chest. She looked as if she were a sleeping princess awaiting her prince. But her prince was in the other room, his guts spilled all over the floor.
"What do you want for $3,500 a night?" Jacoby shrugged. "The whole fairy tale?"
It was taking everything I had just to keep my grip on what I had to do. I glared, as if a single venomous look could shut Jacoby down.
"Jeez, Boxer, what's going on?"
His face sagged.
"It was just a joke."
Whatever it was, his childlike, remorseful expression brought me back. The bride was wearing a large diamond on her right hand and fancy earrings. Whatever the killer's motive, it wasn't robbery. A tech from the medical examiner's office was about to begin his initial examination.
"Looks like 3 stab wounds," he said. "She must have showed a lot of heart. He got the groom with 1.
What flashed through my mind was that fully 90% of all homicides were about money or sex. This one didn't seem to be about money. "When's the last time anyone saw them?" I asked.
"A little after 10 last night. That's when the humongous reception ended downstairs."
"And not after that?"
"I know this isn't exactly your terrain, Boxer," Jacoby said. He broke into a grin. "But generally, people don't see the bride and groom for a while after the party."
I smiled thinly, stood up, looked back across the large, lavish suite. "So, surprise me, Jacoby. Who springs for a room like this?"
"The groom's father is some Wall Street bigshot from back east. He and his wife are down in a room on the 12th floor. I was told it was quite a shindig downstairs. Up here, too. Look at all these goddamn roses."
I went back over to the groom and spotted what looked like a gift box of champagne on a marble console near the door. There was a spray of blood all over it.
"Assistant manager noticed it," Jacoby said. "My guess is whoever did this brought it in with him."
"They see anyone around?"
"Yeah, a lot of people, in tuxes. It was a wedding, right?"
I read the champagne bottle label. "Krug, Clos du Mesnil, 1989.
"That tell you something?" Jacoby asked.
"Only that the killer has good taste." I looked at the blood-smeared tuxedo jacket. There was a single slash mark on the side where the fatal knife wound had gone through.
"I figure the killer must have stripped it off after he stabbed him," Jacoby shrugged.
"Why the hell would he do that?" I muttered out loud.
"Dunno. We'll have to ask him."
Charlie Clapper was eyeing me from the hallway to see if it was okay to get started. I nodded him in. Then I went back to the bride. I had a bad, bad feeling about this one. If it's not about money, then sex. I lifted the fancy tulle lining of her skirt. The coldest, bitterest confirmation sliced through me. The bride's panties had been pulled down and were dangling off 1 foot. A fierce anger rose in my chest. I looked into the bride's eyes. Everything had been ahead of her, every hope and dream. Now she was a slaughtered corpse, defiled, possibly raped on her wedding night. As I stood there, blinking as I stared down at her face, I suddenly realized that I was crying.
"Warren," I said to Jacoby, "I want you to speak with the groom's parents," I said, sucking in a breath. "I want everyone who was on this floor last night interviewed. If they've checked out, I want them traced. And a list of all hotel staff on duty last night."
I knew if I didn't get out now, I couldn't hold back the tide any longer.
"Now, Warren, please, now."
I avoided his eyes as I skirted past him out of the suite.
"What the hell's wrong with Boxer?"
Charlie Clapper asked.
"You know women," I heard Jacoby reply. "They always cry at weddings."
Chapter 7 Philip Campbell was walking along Powell Street toward Union Square and the Hyatt. The police had actually blockaded the street, and the crowd outside the hotel was growing quickly. The howling screams of police and emergency vehicles filled the air. This was so unlike civilized and respectable San Francisco. He loved it. Campbell almost couldn't believe he was headed back to the crime scene. He just couldn't help himself. Being here again helped him to relive the night before. As he walked closer and closer on Powell, his adrenaline surged, his heart pounded, almost out of control. He edged through the mob that populated the final block outside the Hyatt. He heard the rumors swirling through the crowd, mostly well-dressed business people, their faces creased with anguish and pain. There were rumors of a fire at the hotel, a jumper, a homicide, a suicide. But nothing came close to the horror of the actual event. Finally, he got close enough so that he could watch the San Francisco police at work. A couple of them were surveying the crowd, looking for him. He wasn't worried about being discovered, not at all. It just wasn't going to happen. He was too unlikely, probably in the bottom 5% of the people the police might suspect. That comforted him, thrilled him, actually.
God, he had done it, caused all of this to happen.
And he was only just beginning. He had never experienced anything like this feeling. And neither had the city of San Francisco. A businessman was coming out of the Hyatt, and reporters and other people were asking him questions, as if he were a major celebrity. The man was in his early 30s, and he smirked knowingly. He had what they all wanted, and he knew it. He was lording it over everyone, enjoying his pitiful moment of fame. "It was a couple. Murdered in the penthouse," he could overhear the man. "They were on their honeymoon. Sad, huh?" The crowd around Philip Campbell gasped, and his heart soared. Chapter 8 What a scene! Cindy Thomas pushed her way through the murmuring crowd, the looky-loos surrounding the Grand Hyatt. Then she groaned at the sight of the line of cops blocking the way. There must have been 100 onlookers tightly pressed around the entrance, tourists carrying cameras, business people on their way to work. Others were flashing press credentials and shouting, trying to talk their way in. Across the street, a television news van was already setting up with the backdrop of the hotel's facade. After 2 years spent covering local interest on the metro desk of the Chronicle, Cindy could feel a story that might jumpstart her career. This one made the hairs on her neck stand up.
"Homicide down at the Grand Hyatt," her city editor, Sid Glass, had informed her after a staffer picked up the police transmission.
Susie Fitzpatrick and Tom Stone, the Chronicle's usual crime reporters, were both on assignment.
"Get right down there,"
her boss barked, to her amazement. He didn't have to say it twice. But now, outside the Hyatt, Cindy felt her brief run of luck had come to an end. The street was barricaded. More news crews were pulling up by the second. If she didn't come up with something now, Fitzpatrick or Stone would soon be handed the story. What she needed was inside, and here she was out on the curb. She spotted a line of limos and went up to the first one, a big beige stretch. She rapped on the window. The driver looked up over his paper, the Chronicle, of course, and lowered the window as she caught his eye.
"You waiting for Stedman?" Cindy asked.
"Uh-uh," the driver replied. "Edelson."
Sorry,
she waved. But inside she was beaming.
This was her way in.
She lingered in the crowd a few seconds longer, then elbowed her way to the front. A young patrolman blocked her path.
"Excuse me," said Cindy, looking harried. "I've got a meeting in the hotel."
"Name?"
"Edelson. He's expecting me."
The entrance cop paged through a computer printout fastened to a clipboard.
"You have a room number?"
Cindy shook her head.
"He said to meet him in the grill room at 11.
The grill room at the Hyatt was the scene of some of San Francisco's best power breakfasts. The entrance cop gave her a careful once-over. In her black leather jacket, jeans, sandals from Earth's sake, Cindy figured she didn't look the part of someone arriving for a power brunch.
"My meeting," said Cindy, tapping her watch. "Edelson."
Distractedly, the cop waved her through.
She was inside.
The high-glass atrium lobby, gold columns rising to the third floor. It gave her a giggle, all that high-priced talent and all those recognizable faces still outside on the street. And Cindy Thomas was first in. Now she only had to figure out what to do. The place was definitely buzzing. Cops, business people checking out, tour groups, crimson-suited hotel staff. The chief had said it was a homicide. A daring one, given the hotel's prominent reputation. She didn't know which floor, or when it had taken place. She didn't even know if it involved a guest. She may be inside, but she didn't know shit. Cindy spotted a cluster of suitcases unattended on the far side of the lobby. They looked as if they were part of some large tour. A bellhop was dragging them outside. She wandered over and knelt by one of the bags as if she were taking something out. A second bellhop passed by.
"Need a taxi?"
Cindy shook her head no.
"Someone's picking me up."
Then, sweeping a view of the chaos, she rolled her eyes.
"I just woke up. What did I miss?"
"You haven't heard? You must be the only one. We had some fireworks in the hotel last night."
Cindy widened her eyes. "Two murders. On 30. He lowered his voice as if he were letting her in on the secret of her life.
"You happened to run into that big wedding last night? It was the bride and groom. Someone broke in on them in the Mandarin suite."
"Jesus!" Cindy pulled back.
"Sure you don't need these brought out to the front?" the bellhop asked.
Cindy forced a smile.
"Thanks. I'll wait in here."
On the far side of the lobby, she noticed an elevator opening. A bellhop came out, wheeling a cart of luggage. It must be a service elevator. From what she could see, the cops hadn't blocked it off. She wound through the lobby traffic toward the elevator. She punched the button, and the shiny gold door opened.
Thank God it was empty.
Cindy jumped in, and the door closed. She couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe what she was doing. She pressed 30. The Mandarin suite. A double homicide. Her story. Chapter 9. As the elevator came to a stop, Cindy held her breath. Her heart was pumping like a turbine. She was on 30. She was in. She was really doing this. The doors had opened to a remote corner of the floor. She thanked God there wasn't a cop waiting in front of them. She heard a buzz of activity coming from the other end of the hall. All she had to do was follow the noise. As she hurried down the hallway, the voices grew louder. Two men in yellow jackets bearing CSU in large black letters walked past her. At the end of a hall, a group of cops and investigators stood in front of an open double doorway marked Mandarin Suite.
She wasn't only inside. She was right in the fucking middle of it.
Cindy made her way toward the double doors. The cops weren't even looking in her direction. They were letting in police staff who had come from the main elevators.
She had made it all the way. The Mandarin Suite. She could see inside. It was huge, opulent, with lavish decor. Roses were everywhere.
Then her heart almost stopped. She thought she might be sick.
The groom, in a blood-stained tuxedo shirt, lay there on the floor.
Cindy's legs buckled. She had never seen a murder victim before. She wanted to lean forward, to let her eyes memorize every detail, but her body wouldn't move.
"Who the hell are you?"
a brusque voice suddenly demanded. A large, angry cop was staring directly at her face. All of a sudden, she was grabbed and pushed hard against the wall.
It hurt!
In a panic, Cindy pointed to her bag and her wallet, in which a photo press credential was displayed. The angry cop began leafing through her IDs and credit cards as if they were junk mail.
Jesus!
The thick-necked patrolman scowled with a face like a slobbering Doberman.
She's a reporter!
How in hell did you get up here?
His partner came over and demanded.
Get her the hell out,
Doberman barked to him.
And keep the ID. She won't get within a mile of a police briefing for the next year.
His partner dragged her by the arm to the main elevator bank. Over her shoulder, Cindy got a final glimpse of the dead man's legs splayed near the door. It was awful, terrifying, and sad. She was shaking.
Show this reporter to the front door,
he instructed a third cop manning the elevator. He flicked her press ID as if it were a playing card.
Hope losing this was worth the ride up.
As the doors closed, a voice yelled,
Hold it!
A tall woman in a powder blue t-shirt and brocade vest with a badge fastened to her waist stepped in. The cop was nice looking, with sandy blonde hair, but she was clearly upset. She let out a deep sigh as the doors closed.
Rough in there, Inspector? The cop accompanying Cindy inquired.
Yeah, the woman said, not even turning her head. The word inspector went off like a flash in Cindy's mind. Cindy couldn't believe it. The scene must be beyond awful for an inspector to be that upset. As the elevator descended, she rode the entire 30 floors just blinking her eyes and looking straight ahead. When the doors opened to the lobby, the inspector rushed off.
You see the front door? The cop said to Cindy. Go through it. Don't come back.
As soon as the elevator doors had closed, she spun around and scanned the vast lobby for a sight of the detective. She caught a flash of her going into the ladies' room. Cindy hurriedly followed her in. Just the two of them in there. The detective stood in front of a mirror. She looked close to 6 feet tall, slender and impressive. To Cindy's amazement, it was clear she had been crying.
Jesus, Jesus! She was back on the inside again. What had the inspector seen to get her so upset?
You okay? Cindy finally inquired in a soft voice. The detective tensed up when she realized she wasn't alone, but she had this look on her face, as if she were on the verge of letting it all out. You're that reporter, aren't you? You're the one who got upstairs. Cindy nodded. So how did you make it all the way up there?
I don't know. Luck, maybe.
The detective pulled out a tissue and dabbed at her eyes. Well, I'm afraid your luck's over, if you're looking for something from me.
I didn't mean that, Cindy said. You sure you're all right?
The cop turned around. Her eyes shouted, I've got nothing to say to you, but they lied. It was as if she needed to do exactly that, talk to someone more than anything in the world. It was one of those strange moments when Cindy knew there was something under the surface. If the roles just shifted, and she had the chance, the two of them might even become friends. Cindy reached into her pocket, pulled out a card, and placed it on the sink counter in front of the detective.
If you ever want to talk.
The color came back into the inspector's pretty face. She hesitated, then gave Cindy the slimmest, faintest edge of a smile. Cindy smiled in return.
As long as I'm here.
She went up to the sink and took out her makeup kit, catching the policewoman's eye in the mirror.
Nice vest, she said.
Chapter 10. I work out of the Hall of Justice. The hall, as we referred to the gray 10-story granite slab that housed the city's Department of Justice, was located just west of the freeway, on 6th and Bryant. If the building itself, with its faded, antiseptic halls, didn't communicate that law enforcement lacked a sense of style, the surrounding neighborhood surely did. Hand-painted bail bondsman shacks, auto parts stores, parking lots, and dingy cafes. Whatever ailed you, you could find it at the hall. Auto theft, sex crimes, robbery. The district attorney was on 8, with cubicles filled with bright young prosecutors, a floor of holding cells on 10. One-stop shopping, arrest to arraignment. Next door, we even had the morgue. After a hasty bare-bones news conference, Jacoby and I agreed to meet upstairs and go over what we had so far. The 12 of us who covered homicide for the entire city shared a 20-by-30 squad room lit by harsh fluorescent lights. My desk was choice, by the window, cheerily overlooking the entrance ramp to the freeway. It was always covered with folders, stacks of photos, department releases. The one really personal item on it was a plexiglass cube my first partner had given me. It was inscribed with the words, "You can't tell which way the train went by looking at the tracks." I made myself a cup of tea and met Jacoby in Interrogation Room 1. I drew two columns on a freestanding chalkboard, one for what we knew, one for what we had to check out. Jacoby's initial talk with the groom's parents had produced nothing. The father was a big-time Wall Street guy who ran a firm that handled international buyouts. He said that he and his wife had stayed until the last guest had left and walked the kids upstairs. They didn't have an enemy in the world. No debts, addictions, threats. Nothing to provoke such a horrible, unthinkable act. A canvas of guests on the 30th floor had been slightly more successful. A couple from Chicago had noticed a man lingering in the hallway near the Mandarin suite last night around 10:30 p.m. They described him as medium build, with short, dark hair, and said he wore a dark suit or maybe a tuxedo. He was carrying what may have been a box of liquor in his hands. Later, two used tea bags and two empty push-throughs of Pepcid tablets on the table were the clearest signs that we'd been bouncing these questions back and forth for several hours. It was 7:15. Our shift had ended at 5.
"No date tonight, Lindsay?"
Jacoby finally asked. "I get all the dates I want, Warren."
"Right. Like I said, no date tonight."
Without knocking, our lieutenant, Sam Roth, whom we called Cheery, stuck his head into the room. He tossed a copy of the Afternoon Chronicle across the table.
"You see this?"
The bold face headline read, "Wedding Night Massacre at Hyatt." I read aloud from the front page. "Under a stunning view of the bay, in a world only the rich would know, the body of the 29-year-old groom lay curled up near the door." He knotted his brow.
"What, did we invite this reporter in for a house tour of the crime scene? She knows the names, maps out the scene."
The byline read, "Cindy Thomas." I thought of the card in my purse, letting out a long sigh. Cindy goddamn Thomas.
"Maybe I should call her up and ask her if we got any leads," Roth went on.
"You want to come in?" I asked. "Look at the board. We could use the help." Roth just stood there, chewing on his puffy lower lip. He was about to close the door behind him, but he turned back.
"Lindsay, be in my office at 9:15 tomorrow. We need to lay this thing out carefully. For now, it's yours."
Then he shut the door. I sat down on the table. A heavy weight seemed to be pressing on me. The whole day had passed. I hadn't found a single moment to deal with my own news.
"You okay?"
Jacoby asked. I looked at him, on the verge of letting it all out, or maybe crying again.
"That was a tough crime scene," he said at the door. "You should go home, take a bath or something."
I smiled at him, grateful for a sudden out-of-character sensitivity. After he left, I faced the mostly blank columns of the board. I felt so weak and empty, I could barely push myself up. Slowly, the events of the day, my visit to Orenthaler's, wove their way back into my mind. My head spun with his warning. "Fatal, Lindsay." Then I was hit with the crushing realization. It was going on 8:00. I had never called Orenthaler's specialist. Chapter 11. That night, when I got home, I did sort of take Jacoby's advice. First, I walked my dog, sweet Martha. Two of my neighbors take care of Martha during the day, but she's always ready for our nightly romp. After the walk, I kicked off my aerosol pumps, tossed my gun and clothes on the bed, and took a long, hot shower, bringing in Achilleans with me. The image of David and Melanie Brandt washed away for the night. they could sleep. But there was still Orenthaler, and Naegele's, and the call to the specialist I had dreaded the whole day and never made. No matter how many times I lifted my face into the hot spray, I could not rinse the long day away. My life had changed. I was no longer just fighting murderers on the street. I was fighting for my life. When I got out, I ran a brush through my hair and looked at myself for a long time in the mirror. A thought came into my mind that rarely occurred to me. I was pretty. Not a beauty, but cute. Tall, almost 5'10". Decent shape for somebody who occasionally binges on beer and butterscotch praline ice cream. I had these animated, bright brown eyes. I didn't back down. How could it be that I was going to die? Tonight, my eyes were different, though. Scared. Everything seemed different. "Surf the waves," I heard a voice inside me say. "Stand tall. You always stand tall." As much as I tried to press it back, the question formed. Why me? I threw on a pair of sweats, tied up my hair in a short ponytail, and went into the kitchen to boil water for pasta and heat up a sauce I had put in the fridge a couple of nights before. While it simmered, I put on a CD, Sarah McLachlan, and sat at the kitchen counter with a glass of day-old Bianco Red. I petted Sweet Martha as the music played. Ever since my divorce had become final 2 years ago, I had lived alone. I hate living alone. I love people, friends. I used to love my husband, Tom, more than life itself, until he left me, saying, "Lindsay, I can't explain it. I love you, but I have to leave. I need to find somebody else. There's nothing else to say." I guess he was being truthful, but it was the dumbest, saddest thing I'd ever heard. Broke my heart into a million pieces. It's still broken. So even though I hate living alone, except for Sweet Martha, of course, I'm afraid to be with somebody again. What if he suddenly stopped loving me? I couldn't take it. So, I turn down, or shoot down, just about every man who comes anywhere near me. But God, I hate being alone. Especially this night. My mother had died from breast cancer when I was just out of college. I had transferred to the city school from Berkeley to assist her and help take care of my younger sister, Kat. Like most things in her life, even Dad's walking out, Mom dealt with her illness only when it was too late to do anything about it. I had seen my father only twice since I was 13. He wore a uniform for 20 years in Central, was known as a pretty good cop. He used to go down to this bar, the Alibi, and stay for the Giants game after his shift. Sometimes he took me, his little mascot, for the boys to admire. When the sauce was ready, I poured it over Fusilli and dragged the plate and a salad out to my terrace. Martha tagged along. She'd been my shadow since I adopted her from the Border Collie Rescue Society. I lived on Potrero Hill, in a renovated blue Michaelian townhouse, with a view of the bay. Not the fancy view like the one from the Mandarin Suite. I sat down, propped my feet up on a neighboring chair, and balanced the plate on my lap. Across the bay, the lights of Oakland glimmered like 1,000 unsympathetic eyes. I looked out at the galaxy of flashing lights, felt my eyes well up, and for the second time today I realized that I was crying. Martha nuzzled me gently. Then she finished the fusilli for me. Chapter 12 9:15 the next morning, I was rapping at the fogged window of Lieutenant Roth's office at the hall. Roth likes me. "Like another daughter," he says. He has no idea how condescending he can be. I'm tempted to tell Roth that I like him. Like a grandfather. I was expecting a crowd. At least a couple of suits from Internal Affairs. Or maybe Captain Welting, who oversaw the Bureau of Inspectors. But as he motioned me in, I saw that there was only one other person in the room. A nice-looking type, dressed in a chambray shirt and striped tie, with short, dark hair and strong shoulders.
He had a handsome, intelligent face that seemed to come to life as I walked in, but it only meant one thing to me. Polished brass. Someone from the department's press corps. Or City Hall. I had the blunt, uneasy feeling they'd been talking about me. On the way over, I'd rehearsed a convincing rebuttal about the breach in press security, how I'd arrived late on the scene myself, and the real issue was the crime. But Roth surprised me.
"Wedding Bell Blues, they're calling it," he said,
tossing the morning's Chronicle in my face. "I saw it," I replied, relieved to focus back on the case. He looked at Mr. City Hall.
"We'll be reading about this one every step of the way. Both kids were rich. Ivy League. Popular. Sort of like young Kennedy and that blonde wife of his. Their tragedy."
"Who they were doesn't matter to me," I answered. "Listen, Sam, about yesterday..." He stopped me with his hand.
"Forget about yesterday. Chief Mercer's already been on the line with me. This case has his full attention."
He glanced at the smartly dressed political type in the corner.
"Anyway, he wants there to be close reins on this case. What happened on other high-profile investigations can't happen here."
Then he said to me,
"We're changing the rules on this one."
Suddenly, the air in the room got thick with the uneasy feel of a setup. Then Mr. City Hall stepped forward. I noticed his eyes bore the experienced lines of someone who had put in his time.
"The mayor and Chief Mercer thought we might handle this investigation as an interdepartmental alliance. That is, if you were up to working with someone new," he said.
"New?" My eyes bounced back and forth between the two, ultimately settling on Roth.
"Meet your new partner," Roth announced.
"I'm getting royally screwed," a voice inside me declared. "They wouldn't do this to a man."
"Chris Raleigh,"
Mr. City Hall Hotshot said, extending his hand. I didn't reach out to take it.
"For the past few years," Roth went on, "Captain Raleigh has worked as a community action liaison with the mayor's office. He specializes in managing potentially sensitive cases."
"Managing?" Raleigh rolled his eyes at me. He was trying to be self-effacing.
"Containing. Controlling the damage. Healing any wounds in the community afterwards."
"Oh," I shot back. "You're a marketing man." He smiled. Every part of him oozed a practiced, confident air I associated with the kind of men who sat around large tables at City Hall.
"Before that," Roth went on, "Chris was a district captain over in Northern."
"That's Embassy Row," I sniffed. Everybody joked about the blue-blooded Northern District, which ranged from Knob Hill to Pacific Heights. Hot crimes there were society women who heard noises outside their townhouses and late-arriving tourists locked out of their bed and breakfasts. "We also handled traffic around the Presidio," Raleigh countered with another smile. I ignored him. I turned to Roth. "What about Warren?" He and I had shared every case for the past 2 years.
"Jacoby will be reassigned. I've got a plum job for him and his big mouth."
I didn't like leaving my partner behind, dumbass wisecracks and all, but Jacoby was his own worst enemy. To my surprise, Raleigh asked, "You okay with this, Inspector?" I didn't really have a choice. I nodded yes. "If you don't get in the way. Besides, you wear nicer ties than Jacoby."
"Father's Day present," he beamed.
I couldn't believe I felt a tremor of disappointment shooting through me.
"Jesus, Lindsay!"
I didn't see a ring.
"Lindsay!"
"I'm taking you off all other assignments," Roth announced. "No conflicting obligations. Jacoby can handle the back end if he wants to stay on the case."
"So? Who's in charge?" I asked, cheery. I was senior partner to Jacoby. I was used to running my own cases. Roth chortled.
"He works with the mayor. He's an ex-district captain. Who do you think's in charge?"
"How about, in the field, you lead," Raleigh suggested. "What we do with what we find is mine." I hesitated, giving him an evaluating stare.
God, he was so smooth.
Roth looked at me.
"You want me to ask Jacoby if he's got similar reservations?"
Raleigh met my eyes. Look, I'll let you know when we can't work it out. It was as good a negotiation as I was going to get. The deal had changed, but at least I kept my case. So what do I call you? Captain?